I'm a big fan of Westerns, as are so many cinephiles and filmmakers. The Western is so synonymous with cinema history, going back to The Great Train Robbery, one of the first real movies by, you know, modern standards of what a movie is. Anyway, the Western is just an opportunity to use the big canvas to have good versus evil, to find the gray areas in between, to talk about the dark side of American mythology and all that stuff. It is a huge part of our culture, but also our cinematic heritage. And in The Harder They Fall, which is on Netflix, we have a whole new entry into this storied and familiar genre. Why? Because it's about the Black experience in the Western. It is an almost all-Black cast, at least the primary characters, about Black characters in the Western, which is in and of itself entirely unique and worthwhile just to explore that experience. We have seen the Western, just like we've seen so many movies, from only one perspective, maybe a slight variation on the one perspective. This is a new perspective. And unlike Westerns that incorporate Black characters, this Western is truly told from the perspective. It doesn't just incorporate them. It's about them in its entirety and their experience. So why all the big lead-in? Because this is an important special movie. And we, like so many we talk about, but this one for these unique reasons. Today we have cinematographer Mihai Malimer, who shot the movie. He also shot a couple other amazing movies like Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, for example. So this is a genius cinematographer with a great resume. And he talked to me about how they tackled The Harder They Fall, purely from a technical standpoint and a story standpoint, how they shot it, why they shot it the way they did. It's a great listen. I highly recommend the movie. It's really visually interesting and fun. And if you like Westerns, you got to see it. So here we go. First off, I loved The Harder They Fall. I want to talk about the look and shooting it and so much of what inspired it. But looking at your career, you know, there's a variety of stuff. You've shot some incredible movies. What was your sort of, what got you started? How did you launch your career? What were your first steps sort of into cinematography?
It happened when I was 15, I think. It was fairly easy because my father is an actor in Romania. I kind of grew up in Romanian National Theater around actors and all that environment. But I remember when I was 15, my father had a play because he directs as well and he acts in his own plays. And I remember he had a play, it was, I think, Gogol's Overcoat, and he had 180 light changes. And that struck a chord with me. I realized you can do so much with lights, even in a confined space. And the lights are played in the proper spot and they are cued on music and all that. And that kind of stayed with me for a while. And then I got really interested in still photography. And soon after that, I remember telling my father that I want to be a cinematographer.
So you combined theatrical lighting that you witnessed him using. Did he have a style? Did he approach theatrical lighting a certain way that you picked up on?
I remember it was the Martin movers were very new back then, for example. And they were basically the robotic lights that we are using them even in movies now. But those were like quite amazing. And then I remember the lighting board being such a like a huge device with all the manual faders and programs and all that. So it was very interesting, but it was also like the fact that I realized that light can create emotion if it's positioned in the right place, and that definitely started interesting. It was very interesting for me, and combined that with love for cameras. And I remember also my father had it was like a German VHS camera with like an external recorder, and like I started playing with that and like mainly recording like family events and stuff, and then I started helping him with the theater and like recording rehearsals, and like all these combined kind of guided me into cinematography.
And what was the first camera that you started shooting? Like, did you go to school of any kind and get a chance to shoot film? Like, when did you start touching that?
It was, what was really interesting, I remember we, like, he enrolled me into, like, an after-school program, still photography. And even there, it was funny because I went there and I told them, like, okay, we better get started because I'll be a cinematographer. So they were laughing. They're like, okay, let's go into the darkroom and let's start processing. And it was a basic black and white darkroom, but like for me, like going there after school and like having this passion, it was amazing. And lately I put together my own darkroom. They were old Russian still cameras or like East German still cameras with really strange lenses. And I actually have a story about that, which is kind of funny. There were those lenses, I remember I hated them.
And for the stills. This was for stills.
Yeah, this was for stills. But this was 1999 probably. Yeah. But I remember I hated those, and all I wanted was a Nikon lens or any other lens. I was like, I remember as soon as I was like seeing like a magazine with cameras or something, I was just like, my eyes were drawn there. I was like, oh my God, I want a Nikon. I want like a good camera and a good lens. Cut to 5 years ago and me going back to buying Russian lenses on eBay and asking Panavision to rehouse them.
Oh, wow, really?
And actually two of those lenses I had, they're rehoused by Panavision now, and they're part of my usual kit of specialty lenses.
Wow.
So it's funny how things are turning around and they come back.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
That's brings us to an interesting point. You know, you started in a dark room. Well, you actually, sounds like you started with video, but you were in a dark room, you were processing film, you were using old lenses. Now those kinds of old lenses have become important because of the digital medium, right? That's part of how you bring character to the image. And so that's kind of like, you know, you shot, I'm just thinking like The Harder They Fall, you guys shot on the Alexa?
No, it was the Panavision DXL2.
Oh, okay. And how different is something like that from shooting The Master, for example, which, you know, with Paul Thomas Anderson, I'm assuming is film.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with a completely different thing, but how do you, you know, when you switch over to the other medium, this I think is a problem a lot of cinematographers at all levels have. How do you bring the same character to it?
It's interesting. I mean, the film school in Romania back then was, the program was 4 years and it was all based on film. So yeah. I already had that plus stills. I think it's an interesting combo, and it's funny. It's not as the jump, if you do it quite a few times, it's not as drastic as you would think. It's scary at the beginning because you have to look up for different things. But for now, for example, I just finished a project, a TV show where we shot only film for the last 6 months. So,
oh yeah,
yeah. So that would be interesting. And I'm still shooting stills quite a lot, and I do have a lot of cameras, still cameras. For example, I mean, I feel embarrassed to say, but like I have like 36 cameras.
Many mostly stills. What kinds?
No, the stills, all of them stills cameras. This is what happened when the digital still cameras became more and more interesting and better than all the amazing old film still cameras became like really like cheaper and cheaper. And it was like with Craigslist and eBay, it was like a dream come true. Like all the cameras I always dreamed of having,
yeah,
all of a sudden they were so cheap. I was like, I
so it's more for you with the stills, you just get to take out these different cameras, use stock, you dark room yourself?
Kind of, it's a hybrid. I mean, I do have it's a mini lab that can process C41 or black and white, and then you scan it and you use Photoshop or Lightroom. And that's why it's not a real dark room. It's more just a tank that can process the film, that can only develop, and then you use your scanner. But it's still, I mean, I try to do it as much as possible, but it's still close to how it used to be.
And do you ever, does this just pure hobby and passion, or does it ever cross over into the work on a movie or a show?
It does, because what I realized is like having all these cameras and all these amazing lenses, not only that, like for me, sometimes it's like either therapy while I'm on location, or either keeping the creative juices going. I don't know how to call it, but what I end up doing is like having so many stills that I can show directors, and it's very easy to say like, oh, okay, if you wanna see how a 1950s lens looks on a Rolleiflex, I can show you some examples here, or a Mamiya lens from the 90s, and it's very easy. I found myself, it's like it's very interesting to talk about visual references and all that, but as soon as you show somebody an image, you get a feedback right away, and I think
it's
kind of the best feedback you would want from a director. And I think the goal is to be able to learn right away what they like, or and more, most importantly, what they hate. So
yeah,
in that way, I think I'm using the stills for experimental.
Tell me about this. This keeps coming to mind because The Master is such a gorgeous celluloid piece of art, like visually. What's it like working with Paul Thomas Anderson? And do you show him the stills and talk? Is that one where you were like, we're doing period, you know, we're doing format, you know, did you talk about lenses from the era, stuff like that?
It was a little bit, but I remember because like Paul is such an interesting character and he knows a lot about lenses and cameras and everything. But I do remember, for example, like carrying my Kontax 645 quite a lot when we were scouting. And it was very interesting because we spoke about a larger negative very early on, but in our mind, the larger negative was just for some portraits. And because the main character was working in a portrait studio, we thought like, oh, like probably 10% we can use this format and then shoot everything in 35. But and I remember actually taking some stills on like 4x5. It was an interesting process, but it was more for us to discover if the format and how much we want to use that format. And I don't think the stills did anything in that particular example, but I think what it did, because we were actually watching dailies projected for that.
Oh wow. That's
film, which is kind of unbelievable. And as soon as we were watching a 65mm shot, we all like realized like, oh my god, we have to use this more often. And by the end of day three, I think we switched and we were shooting probably 90% of the movie on 65 and the rest on 35. But I think even there, it was kind of a little bit of the process. Like for example, the crown graphic that Freddie, that Joaquin's character is using in the movie, that's one of my cameras.
Oh, cool.
I mean, we had more of them, and I remember the props department was really worried that he would damage my camera. But also, like, I remember, for example, they worked with him as well, but I showed him how to change the neg, and because it's such a specific camera, that crown graphic.
Yeah.
So it's like intertwined quite a lot.
Yeah, I guess it's part of the story, and it's part of what's happening on screen. So take me like now in something like The Harder They Fall. It's, you know, completely different, but also steeped in film history because it's a Western. And I know it's like a unique, this is a completely unique perspective. in a Western. But did you guys, you and James, did you like look through Western cinema and take your cues to some extent? Did you, you know, it has kind of a, I would describe almost like a music video feel in a lot of sequences.
Yeah.
Colors are vibrant and alive throughout it, which for these days, I feel like people go desaturated and muted a lot. So that was kind of nice. Like, tell me about the visual decision-making and just the process.
It's, we spoke about different movies. I don't think we watched more than three movies together. We didn't really have a lot of time, but we spoke about a lot of Westerns we both loved. And now, me being from Romania, it's like the whole Sergio Leone is more like a part of that European cinematic pride, if you think
yeah.
about it. But that being said, what was interesting about Sergio Leone was like how dusty everything was all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Compared to a more. But, and I remember James bringing it up and saying, you know, like I want a certain color saturation, and I want things to feel sometimes that as if they're like print, like photographs printed on a high gloss paper. And he brought a very interesting visual reference. It's an amazing painter called Kadir Nelson. His color saturation, it's truly remarkable, and combining the idea of printing on high gloss paper with Kadir Nelson's images, like all of a sudden, like opened a new thing for me. And I was like trying to figure out, also coming from Georgia, where we went for color saturation as well, like here it was probably that plus 50% more. Like every time we're looking for certain colors and like in other references, it was like, oh yeah, it's this plus 30% more. It's this red plus 20%.
Wow, yeah. More. I mean, you know, thinking about the Kadir Nelson, and for listeners, I think he's had some New Yorker covers. If you're,
yeah,
if you go look up, it's, yeah, it pops. It's kind of like I'd say almost like a modern Rockwell.
Yeah,
but
it's really amazing. Yeah.
And that's a funny reference because it has a kind of Americana, but I think I know why he picked it, because it's a Black America, like seen through that lens, you know, that makes sense. And that's so much of what the movie is. I want to know more about, you know, the Western. So you talked about Leone, you can see the Leone influence in the script, I think, in terms of how you shoot action and Western influence. What were the three movies you watched together? What did you talk about?
Because I remember telling him, like, I still remember the first time as a kid when I watched the Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid or the Wild Bunch. And like the Wild Bunch came so many times in our discussions, and like we're like talking about, it's like, oh yeah, I was like, remember how violent that was? Like, let's look at it. Let's see what we can learn. And I remember watching that together with James, and we were like, yeah, actually it's great.
Yeah.
We should try to figure out how to incorporate it. But it was an ongoing discussion, and it was also the idea that like we have to create something new. And you always say that with your newest project, but I do believe we kind of took our time and came up with solutions that not only that they weren't possible 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, but also trying to figure out an approach that would pay tribute to all the movies as well, and to the genre. Now, to be fair, it's like it's not as complicated, because in my mind was that we'll have to go anamorphic no matter what. Like there's a certain framing that you'll find yourself, like a cowboy hat and a gun belt will force you into a certain framing.
I love that comment.
And it's also like it helps from in so many perspectives, because I remember like going into the first director scout and seeing how reflective the ground is in New Mexico, and they're like talking about like, oh, should we do overheads, should we go for a softer approach? And then we realized, like, you know, like again, a cowboy hat will be your overheads, and with a bounce from the ground, you don't need anything else, you can shoot right away.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things that will come to, like the way, like just working with horses, and it's and wide vistas and all that.
There's so much So many exteriors. Yep. There's two things I was thinking about in watching it. One was so much is exterior. So much is in that town. The town, I assume, was like a standing set you had.
Yeah.
And you're outside and you're trying to create a certain look. So how much really on set each day? We started this conversation. You were talking about creating with light. How much crafting that massive light? Do you have tons of overhead sun? Were you lucky enough to be overcast sometimes? Like, did you have big bounce cards? Like, how did you craft the light outside? Because crafting light in a theater with the lights you place out of darkness is a completely different thing.
Yeah. It was an interesting combination. I mean, we realized right away that it's like, this is not like the overheads won't help us. Not only that, we wanted to go fairly wide and fairly tight in the same scene and trying to move as fast as possible. So we just took our chances and decided, like, you know, everybody will be wearing a cowboy hat. So no overheads. We don't need to control that. We'll be there. And if it's harsh, it's harsh. It can work. It was a little bit of a challenge trying to schedule around where the sun is. Now, if you're picky and if you go for certain scenes, for certain big scenes outside, you might see the sun jumping from one side to another. But
yeah,
I think we kind of tried to play around that and be as consistent as possible. But with a big scene that we shot over multiple days, it was very hard to do that. But we were trying to at least like plan it like either early morning or late evening, just so we see all those long shadows and take advantage of those. Now, when we went for the night scenes, we started to be a little more, but I don't think it was necessarily theatrical. It was, and I always love to go back to like the same way in a contemporary story. Now you just look at a set with practicals and see what they're doing and try to see where you need extra light and how to enhance those. The same way we built it like 150 or like some crazy number of practicals. And essentially they were like petrol lamps that were retrofitted with tiny 150 watt tungsten bulbs.
Oh, cool. You mean like in the bar, like inside the bars?
Like in the bar, like in pretty much all the interiors. Yeah. And the reason for still using tungsten, because like we went for 150 watt bulbs just to be able to run those at like 20 or 30 or 40% and get the warmth from them. But also everything was running through a dimmer board that had a flicker gag to simulate that flame.
So you had it on a randomized kind of flicker. Yeah, so they all were flickering a little bit to create that candle.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And we looked at, like, as I always like to compare it to the real thing, like when you look at like real petrol lamps, like they're so dimmed. It's quite unbelievable. But for example, Redwood had so many street lights. They were supposed to be gas lamps, basically. And we retrofitted those as well and ran through. And there were like multiple programs. So there is a random flicker. It's not like all the lights are flickering in the same cadence. We're trying
to... Now you make me want to rewatch just to look for the flickers.
it's very subtle, but I think it helps so much because it's like it's kind of like the real thing. You'll have some movement in the flame, like inside a glass ball. But I think like our gaffer Jay Kemp did an amazing job.
Yeah. And those interiors, I mean, you also had such rich colors. Another fascinating visual aspect of this movie to me is when they go to the white town and like around the third act. And you guys made this choice that it was an actual white town. And it makes the visuals so stark because suddenly you're seeing like, oh, I've been looking at a world of color and now I'm looking at this world like that has lost color. And there's so much meaning there, but shooting it must have been something of a challenge, right? Because white is tough.
Yeah. But again, like if you don't shy away from it and embrace it, then there are tools to deal with that. Especially now, like where I'm working with with this amazing DIT for 12 years. Eli Berg is his name. And like, we did so many projects together that it's like, he knows I like to take risks, but like, he keeps me in check all the time.
Yeah.
And I told him, I was like, everything will be white. We'll figure out. I don't want to ask for off-white. And you know, like how a lot of times, like when like choosing paint or anything, curtains, like they will be asking you if you want to go off-white. And I'm trying to not to cheat and go like, and let them choose whatever white they think and just deal with it. I think
it's one of the first things you're taught is don't shoot white walls, don't shoot in a white room.
I think it's a mistake, because it's like, yeah, you'll find, like, of course you put yourself in a corner, but you get more interesting things. And just by dealing with that, I think any restriction kind of opens up a back door to some great solutions, you know. And that was the same case. We had to deal with it. But like, on the other hand, like, if you think about it, it's like the red dress, how that pops against like bright, yeah, white and,
yes,
and all that. So we went for it, and with Eli's help, we were right at the peak with the exposure. Like, anything more than that would have lost information. But just placing ourselves there, like, it's the same thing as when you have a winter snow scene, and like,
right,
you cut from an interior to an exterior, and it's just like your eyes hurt in the theater. But it's a good thing. It's an interesting point you're making there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's story. It creates story, yeah, just, yeah, through the change. Yeah. But I'm sure in certain challenges of lighting it and just keeping it exposed properly, and,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
also their faces, you know, like trying to, like you mentioned that with the hats and stuff, trying to keep the faces, yeah, illuminated enough. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the hats. I hadn't thought of that. Was it a tough shoot? I mean, just in terms of scheduling and all the action and all the stuff, like, was it a challenge to get it all done?
No, amazingly not. And I mean, it was tough because we were in the middle of a pandemic, and all of a sudden we have to figure out how to do it and to learn how to wear all the extra gear and all that.
Oh, but, wow. So I didn't know I didn't know that production happened, like the pandemic came during the production?
No, I mean, it did. And then the production stopped, but we actually started prep in late June and then started shooting in late August.
I see.
So it was pretty much in the middle of it. And I'm assuming just one of the few productions, like, starting again and trying to figure out how to do it while keeping everybody safe and testing every day and dealing with this new thing. But on the other hand, James, his personality and everything, it's like he has fun. And it's like, I like that so much, because this is kind of my theory as well. I think we have the most beautiful job in the world, and might as,
yeah,
well be having fun while we're doing it.
You can tell. There's some movies where you can tell people are having fun, and I thought, yeah, this was one.
Yeah.
It seemed like everybody was kind of in the zone and enjoying themselves, and it makes it fun to watch.
Yeah, I think the whole spirit was like, everybody wanted to make this movie so bad, and it was fun, and it was like, it's easy, and you get so much more creative when the crew is taken care of and when the schedule is made not just to make days but just to make great days,
you know? Yeah.
And when all the thought is put towards the quality of the scenes and not the quantity. And that was the approach, and like, it was by far, I think, one of the safest productions I've been on. And
wow,
it was quite amazing. And all together, like, the first AD and the producers, like, there were so many schedule changes because of the whole pandemic situation, and like, everybody tried to make it in such a way that doesn't affect the crew hours as much and keeps the quality of the material as high as possible.
That's really cool. Well, we're running out of time, but I usually like to end on asking something like this. What would you advise to somebody who's starting out today who wants to become a cinematographer or wants to work in a camera department?
It's funny because, like, we're all so different, so it's like, I don't know if what worked for me might work for everybody else, but I think still just like, shoot as many stills as possible and watch as many movies.
Yeah, it seems like the stills really were a big part of your And continue to be.
Yes.
Well, if you have them anywhere, let us know so we can see them.
Sure.
And I can direct people to a place where they can see all your stills.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Mihai, for coming on the podcast. Thank you to everyone for listening. Please like, rate, and subscribe. Leave us a comment. I'm doing a new thing now. If you leave a 5-star review, I will read it on the podcast on our weekly show. So go ahead, leave a 5-star review on iTunes, and I'll read whatever you write, no matter what. I promise. Please head over to nofilmschool.com and check out what we're doing there. All kinds of stories about filmmaking, filmmaking education, film gear and tech news. And be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, give us a shout out, ask us questions at editor@nofilmschool.com. And stay tuned for tons of great interviews like this one with filmmakers, cinematographers, editors, all the craftspeople who make the movies and television shows you watch happen. Thanks so much for listening.